Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the FCC. My name is Florence de Changy. I'm on the board of governors as a correspondent. I'm the correspondent for Le Monde and French National Radio here. And I'm delighted to be your host today. So, housekeeping business first. Make sure you mute your phone, please. You can tweet about the event, obviously, but make sure it doesn't ring. And coming up events, we have mainly tomorrow a small event, actually more like a workshop, guidelines on suicide reporting. You're still welcome to join, a difficult topic. Now, to what we're here for today, Malaysia in crisis. Malaysia, as you may know, is not an easy story to report. I know that myself because I was posted there for 3 years. It's a place that doesn't seem to like journalists, and it's also a place that journalists don't seem to like that much. So it's always a little bit problematic to touch on Malaysia. Now, I won't elaborate on the many aspects of the current crisis, as I expect our speaker to do just that. But let me tell you a little bit more about Wong Chen that we're very happy and honored to have with us today. So Wong Chen is a member of Malaysian Parliament on the opposition side, as you may have understood. He's the chairman of the Investment and Trade Bureau of Anwar Ibrahim's party. I knew Wong Chen in Kuala Lumpur back at the beginning of year 2000 when he was a corporate lawyer, but he then later on had to resign from his job the day he became a candidate. So he's now a full-time politician. So along with other committed members like Rafizi Ramli, Nuruliza, Tony Pua that you may also know about, he has followed very closely the big fiscal and economic issues, first and foremost, of course, the one MDB scandal that we all know about. Recently, he also coordinated the opposition fight against the draconian amendments to the Sedition Act and the Prevention of Terrorism Bill, which, as we know, still passed. So he's a close policy advisor to the opposition leader, Anwar Ibrahim, who is in jail again with a 5-year term this time. So I, like all of you, I'm sure, I'm very keen to hear Wong Chen comment about his country in crisis. Please welcome Wong Chen.
Thank you, Florence. It was Florence's idea to get me here to KL, to Hong Kong. Good timing as well, because you know what we know from yesterday is that the opposition will meet in Parliament tomorrow at noon, and if the speaker does not allow the event to take place, there might be a bit of commotion Malaysian style, and there's a likelihood that arrests will be made, and it's really good to be in Hong Kong right now. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for inviting me to speak about my beloved Malaysia. Now, Malaysia has been on the news for a bit. I've actually prepared a whole text here because I realized that this will be videoed. And in Malaysian context, you have the freedom to speak. You may not have the freedom after speaking. So it's important to actually read this stuff and try not to get sued or put into jail for sedition. Now, Malaysia has been in the international news for the last 2 years, starting from the tragedy of MH370. That's very perplexing. Nobody knows where it's going, what's going on. Massive amount of conspiracy theories, as you all know. I will not dwell into that. I think Florence is the expert on conspiracy theories on MH370. And then we had the MH17 tragedy. And then subsequently, we had a few other issues. In particular, this year, we had the Rohingya boat case, the boat people crisis. And then, surprisingly, we found 100 graves in Malaysia, and then we found another 100 graves in Malaysia. So what we know in Malaysia is that the slave trade is well and alive, and according to government-owned documents and report, is that it's been going on at least for 5 years. So this is what we have from the international news. This perception that the country is facing a lot of bad luck right? And sometimes, you know, things that is happening inside Malaysia by the own doing of the authorities. Then we had the crazy story on the British naked tourists taking photos in Kinabalu. And customary beliefs in the in Sabah, of course, requires you to sacrifice 10 water buffaloes to atone for your sins for taking off your clothes on the mountain. Now, this kind of story, of course, gives a very negative picture on Malaysian government, because it just shows you that there's a disconnect between Malaysia and the outside world. Now, to me, I'm a, as a member of parliament and also a member of PKR, the People's Justice Party, where Anwar is our leader. Of course, the big news for me is really the jailing of Anwar Ibrahim this year. We all know that Anwar is now 67 years old. He has a history of back pain. He was made to sleep on the floor with a small mattress of 2 inch for about 3 weeks before they finally gave him a bed. He has finally been given a chair about a month ago. And we know he's 67, right? But, you know, the Malaysian judiciary, they are fiercely independent, as you all know. And in their infinite wisdom, believe that a 67-year-old man could rape a 6-foot-tall 24-year-old Malay boy. So that trial, I sat for about 16 days in total. There were two trials. Everybody came out, you know, feeling that there was just no hope in the Malaysian judiciary. Anwar cannot see his family now. He gets to see his family once every 3 weeks through a glass cover. They can't really touch him. So the only way we actually can see the boss and shake his hand or to physically touch him is when he's sued by the government or he's suing the government for trials. So now the trials that that he has pursued or being sued upon is the only avenue for us to really connect with our leader. Now, let me just talk a little bit about the other news, because while Anwar being in jail is a major setback for the opposition, we also had a recent setback, which is the opposition imploding. The Pakatan Rakyat, or the coalition against the government, has in spirit, whether it's formally ended or not, but in spirit it has ended. Yeah. And you think that this setback is damaging or will give the Malaysian government a boost? It hasn't, of course, because the Malaysian government is now facing their own internal crisis over the 1MDB. And this crisis stems from Dr. Mahathir fighting Prime Minister Najib, and it goes really deep. And the basic argument is about accountability and transparency, which is very ironic because most of you know who Dr. Mahathir is and the way he ruled for the last, you know, he ruled for 22 years, and he's basically given the style of politics and handed it over to Najib. Now, the other thing that I would like to talk about is this general idea that we are now witnessing a lot of movements in politics in Malaysia. There seemed to be a vacuum in terms of statesmanship or pushing the government forward. It's just a lot of mess on politicking. Now, we know members of parliament from the backbenches, which means they are with the government, but they're not ministers. The backbenches are plotting. And every other week, the pendulum swings from anti-Najib to pro-Najib. And this will continue for some time to come. And with this latest expose on the 1MDB and the bank account issue, that's not going to go away. We've seen the Deputy Prime Minister issue a statement seeking greater transparency. Now, publicly voicing your position in Malaysian politics is the no-no. Nobody ever dares to speak against the Prime Minister. So we're going to see a second round of big tussle going around. Now, there are also some crazy news coming out of Malaysia, and most of you will heard about the Allah issue. Allah, as you know, is an Arabic word for God. A year ago, the Islamic authorities, which is basically the government, deemed that non-Malays or non-Muslims cannot use the word Allah. So as a result, they seized a few of these Christian Bibles that were written in Malay, for fear that, you know, if a Malay man picks up this Bible and it's written in Malay and it mentions Allah, that they might suddenly give up their faith in Islam and convert to Christianity. Now, this is an official government position. And it just illustrates to you how insecure or how backward thinking the government is on this matter. And we have seen also the local news. I'm sure most of you wouldn't have read of this, but there was the SEA Games recently, Southeast Asian Games. It's a mini Olympics of sorts. And there was a Malaysian gymnast that competed and she won gold. But instead of congratulating her, the nation got together through the social media and scolded her for not dressing appropriately for the competition. She was in leotards competing in gymnastics. So what we see is the government losing its plot a lot actually. We're starting to see the Malaysian community through social media, a high level of intolerance. And that to me as a politician is really worrying. You know, we can take the authoritarian government, we're used to it. As a member of parliament, when I joined the party in 2009, I told, you know, we had this personal conversation with my wife, and we decided that we should, you know, have a nest somewhere else before I enter politics. So we put a bit of money in Singapore, right? And then we decided what we're going to do about our kids. We have a plan where to go in case I get arrested. I mean, these are real things that we discuss as members of parliament. It's not an unusual thing to have plan B. Now, but when you have an authoritarian government and you know your risk, you do it because you love your country. But it's when the people starts to turn against you and starts to think in very intolerant levels, whether it's Malays pushing for their entitlements, or whether it's the Chinese who counter-reacts and take racist attitude, the country just seems that it's divided on many issues. And this is the real challenge of being a member of parliament. How do we fight a government that controls the media, that has elections which are not fair nor free, that during election I didn't get a minute of airtime, that the local media will report me as a conniving, opportunistic lawyer, a candidate. you know, this carries on normally. I mean, we happily fight these elections, right? It's just that when the people start to express very strange views about Islam or about, you know, what a multiracial country should be, then that's the real challenge in all this. Now, I've of course digressed a lot, I'm sure. I'm losing my points here. But essentially, this is the point I want to make. What you hear, and you guys, some are reporters and some are, of course, you're here for the lunch, I think. Not a lot of Malaysian faces here. But the point I want to make is this. The news you get is reflective of what is happening in Malaysia. And the pure news is the government has lost its moral compass. And by losing that moral compass, it is now influencing the people, the community, to act and behave in an erratic manner. Intolerance, disunity, disharmony, these are the norms every day. And we see it because the social media is now such a powerful tool, and it's just gone up and up. And the government hasn't done much to stop this, despite the rhetoric or the official position that we are a multiracial country, that we should promote unity. Now, I just want to say that some of you, if you're a reporter, you have covered the MH370, and you've probably been equally frustrated by the way reporters and also victims or families of victims have been treated on this matter. In Malaysia, for Malaysians, right, this kind of display, what I'll call arrogant incompetence by the Malaysian government, it's just a daily event. You know, it's just a day in the life of most Malaysians. So that's the introduction bit. I've got about maybe 15 minutes to go. So you can't talk about Malaysia in about 15 minutes, but I'll try. I'll try to limit this down to three basic topics. One, of course, everybody's here to listen to about 1MDB. The second one, I'll just give you an update about opposition politics with the view that can we win? Can we win? Can we ever rule? Can we beat this behemoth that is Barisan Nasional? And the last one is just to give you some policy ideas in the event that we win, the politics of hope. What are we planning? And, you know, I'm the technocrat in the party. And so this is really up my alley. So let's just start with the 1MDB first. Now, you know that 1MDB is a strategic investment fund. It is not really an investment fund per se, in the sense that there's excess money in the government, and the government gave them, you know, a couple of billion to spend. That's not the case. You really have to get to grips with the fundamental issue, which is they borrowed money. This is a fund built on borrowed money. And the way they borrowed it is quite simple. They go to the bank and they say, I need a couple of billion dollars. And so, do you have a business model? No, I don't. Then how are we going to give you the money? The government is going to guarantee it. So basically, it's based on the government guarantee. And they were able to borrow about 4%, 5%. And implicitly, explicitly, the government guarantees the fund. Now, if you run such a fund, a strategic fund of this nature, the first order of business is to make sure that you buy assets that gives you better return than 4 to 5%. So you can service the least you can do is service your interest and make sure you get the return back. That hasn't happened. They went and borrowed up to 11.6 billion US dollars or 42 billion ringgit. They bought a lot of assets. They bought land. There's nothing strategic about land unless you're in Hong Kong. You know, Malaysia's got ample land. They bought a lot of land. They bought government land at very low prices. This is the irony. Government land they bought at very low prices. And then they revalued this land in order to pad up their investment portfolio. Okay? But when they come to buying land from private citizens or private individuals, they paid 2 times or 3 times market rate. They also went to buy the power plants, independent power plants, right, in Malaysia. They bought 2, but they were very old. These power plants had like 3 to 4 years left in their lifespan. And most power plants last for 21 years, which is basically the power purchasing agreement. So they bought very old power plants. They paid double for that. All these are available online, not from, you know, from bloggers and stuff. You can actually read all the financial reports from companies that covered this issue. Now, so they bought land and they bought power plants. The rest, we don't know what they bought. So The Edge, which is a reputable financial paper in Malaysia, they have a paper in Singapore as well, did a lot of research on this matter. And it's better to quote them, otherwise I'll get sued. The Edge has reported that there's somewhere between 17 billion ringgit to 25 billion ringgit is unaccounted for. They cannot produce an asset to match those investments. So that is the hole. That is the real story on 1MDB. This massive hole, 42 billion in debt, of which assets, missing assets are 25 billion. Now, how does this relate to the recent story about the bank account? Now, I want to take you back a bit to a week ago, last week, when a Swiss guy with the name of Javier Justo was arrested in Koh Samui. I'm sure some of you might have read about this. Now, he worked for a company called Petro Saudi. Now, Petro Saudi was a company that did the very first 1MDB deal. Now, I'll tell you this story to illustrate to you what actually goes on in the micro level, other than the macro picture of them, you know, not being able to produce assets to support what their borrowings. The Petro Saudi deal is a joint venture. In the simplest term, Petro Saudi claims to have assets in Turkmenistan and Argentina. 1MDB had $1 billion to spend, right? They formed a new joint venture company. We call it a new co. And someone put in the assets and the other guy put in the cash. And 1MDB is supposed to get 40% out of this deal and 60% remains with Petro Saudi. This deal was signed. The company was formed 10 days before signing, right? In the deal, and because I'm a corporate lawyer, I read it, I nearly fell off laughing. The audacity of the deal. There was no financial or legal due diligence attached. There was no references to anything of that sort. There's no valuation report on what the value of the Turkmenistan or Argentina oil fields are, right? So what you had was a transaction that looked very strange, rushed through, and in addition to everything else, Petro Saudi pumped in $700 million into this company just before signing. And once the $1 billion went in, the new co, the new company with the $700 million, had to repay it back to Petro Saudi. So basically, they devised a way to remove this money, you know, pushed in the money within a few days and then removed it immediately. So that's what we saw. And the audacity of the agreement requested 1MDB to do a valuation report on the Turkmenistan and Argentina assets within 3 days of signing. They are putting $1 billion. The guy who is pushing these assets has not produced a report, and the buyer, the guy who's coming in to buy a stake, has to produce a valuation report within 3 days. I don't think you can fly to Turkmenistan to actually look at the assets within 3 days, what less than produce a report. So what we saw is this, a really dodgy deal at many levels with very questionable terms, you know? And that, my friends, is the first ever 1MDB deal. And that was in 2009. What has occurred since then, we have no idea. We know about the land deals, we know about the power plants. What the rest of it, the 25 billion question mark, the 17 billion to 25 billion question mark, remains unknown. Now, let's fast forward now to Javier's arrest. As I said earlier, this director of Petro Saudi. Now, he's been, the news has been covering him as an opportunistic blackmailer that is trying to blackmail Petro Saudi for another 10 million ringgit. His severance pay to leave Petro Saudi was 15 million ringgit. You know, that's quite substantial. On current exchange rate is about $3 million. He was paid to leave the company. Now, the story is Javier then took this bunch of documents and gave it to Sarawak Report. And Sarawak Report has been giving these documents to other reporters. And in the latest issue, Sarawak Report worked with the Asian Wall Street Journal on the expose. Now, Sarawak Report is run by a really tenacious woman. Her name is Claire Brown. She's the sister-in-law of Gordon Brown. And she lives in London, so she has no worries about being sued by the Malaysian government. So she's happily churning out reports and giving us data. And the Malaysian opposition has been relying on mostly her data to question the government in parliament. Now, what happened is this. I was in parliament that day, and in the middle of the minister explaining the 1MDB story to our question, a backbencher, a guy from the government party, stood up and suggested that maybe some members of parliament from the opposition have been using bad information or wrong information and somehow has been shorting the ringgit down, causing great dissatisfaction in the community, in the business community, causing the ringgit to come down. And the guy has had the audacity to suggest that the Malaysian government start investigating us for economic sabotage. I mean, this happened in parliament. I was just so surprised. The government has lost a bunch of money, billions, right? And for us, who are the critics, who get information from Sarawak Report and start questioning in parliament, now we could be under investigation very soon. And sure enough, after 6 days after this guy said this, parliament session ended, Javier was arrested. And the new narrative emerged immediately that the Malaysian government believes that Javier tampered with all the documents that they supplied to Sarawak Report, and therefore it's open season on the opposition. Now this is the level that the Malaysian government operates. And you have to be there to believe, you know, what they're willing to do. In Parliament they passed a law called the Sedition Act. Well, they amended to the Sedition Act, they strengthened it. They passed a law to bring back indefinite detention without trial. So if you come to Malaysia and you do certain things and the government is not happy with you, they might just pick you up and throw you in jail forever. There is no recourse for any judicial review or nothing. You can't do a habeas corpus application to get any form of justice. It's like an episode in Kafka or something, a book from Kafka. You just get into there and you don't know what to do, right? Now, this is a government that practices this. So this is where the issue on 1MDB, it's been revealed that, you know, 700 million went into a bank account linked to the Prime Minister. What are they willing to say now? Are they willing to say that the Asian Wall Street Journal is working with Dr. Mahathir in a political sabotage, trying to remove the Prime Minister? He claims that he's been elected democratically. But if you bring any observer of any repute, Malaysia doesn't have free and fair election. We all know that. So where will this story carry through? What we know so far, and this is a bit of a speculation, is the fact that if you want to investigate bank accounts in Malaysia, the only authority that can do that is the central bank. So a lot of us suspect that the central bank authority or someone in the central bank is the whistleblower on this particular case. And we shall see whether tomorrow there'll be a parliamentary session. I'm not hopeful of that. But there might be commotion Malaysian style in parliament, at the gates possibly. And I've actually instructed my lawyer to be on standby because I fly back tomorrow to KL to meet me in the airport just in case. So I think that's the bit I want to talk about 1MDB. And let me just get on to the other topic, which is really opposition politics. We have time? Yeah. Opposition politics, very, very quickly. In the last election, we had an alliance with the Democratic Action Party, right, which are mostly predominantly Chinese Democrats, multiracial platform, but a small component of multiracial platform. Then that's my party, run by Anwar Ibrahim, a truly multiracial party. And then we had the Islamists. Now, these Islamists are not what the perception given out there. They're not, you know, mullahs, and they're not crazy Taliban people. They're not ISIS supporters. They're Islamists who believe in governance issue, better governance. Of course, we disagree in some issues on hudud, you know, the Islamic law. But the good news is, well, not really good news, but the Islamist party recently had their own internal election. And the fundamentalists in the party have taken over. As a result, the progressive from the Islamist party is moving out. And they take the view that, you know, they should be more progressive, more democratic by nature. So this new wing that is going out, they will form a party within the next three months. Might be earlier, might be a bit later, depending on their mobilization. But for the first time in Malaysian history, you will have a coalition of three parties committed to democratic principles and very progressive ideas. In 2013, we always had the little issue of the fundamentalist inside there, the fundamentalist Islamists. But I think in the coming election, it will look really good. And as a result, immediately after the reshuffling of the Islamist party, internal dispute between them, and the forming of the new party, I've had about 4 or 5 meetings with embassies, and all the embassies are interested in one thing. They believe now we have a proper coalition. They believe now that we are united on progressive Malaysia, and they asked us simple questions: what are we going to do if we start to rule? Now, this brings me to the last issue, which is policies that we may run in Malaysia if the opposition wins. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to win, but we feel good about this. I mean, I've never been so optimistic in my life on the prospects of winning an election. But, you know, Malaysian election is not easy. It's not easy because gerrymandering, right? We have seats 1-10 ratio. That means the smallest seat in parliament is 15,000 voters, and the biggest is 150,000, and that represents one parliamentary seat. So we got those democratic issues to sort out. We got no access to the media, or what you call mass media. We only have the internet, and we have no access to television and radio. And the government is committed to redrawing the boundaries very soon. So whatever they throw at us, we think we will win. Now, what will we do when we win? The first thing we have to do is to recognize that Malaysia has 1.3 million people have migrated out. My friend here, Kelvin, works here in... I've invited him to come to this. And he works here in Hong Kong, and he's been outside of Malaysia for 25 years. Now, I expect him to come back if we start to rule. What we're going to do is this. The first thing is, you know, you go for the low-hanging fruit. You just roll out democratic issues. You try and clean up democracy in Malaysia, put in place free and fair election, allow the press to be free, make sure that the members of parliament are well paid so that you cut out this dependency on money, which will corrupt the administration. You make sure the Prime Minister serves only 2 terms maximum. Things like that can be done, and they're cheap. There's no financial cost to it. right? So get that out, and what I expect is 1.3 million Malaysians out there. We should be able to attract maybe 100,000 back in the first 2 years, okay? So people like Kelvin, you know, he's loaded with money, he's made 25 years of wealth from Hong Kong. I expect him to bring back at least $200,000. Now, if we get 100,000 back, what we call a democracy dividend to the country, right? We should get about $20 billion injection immediately. Now, once you take government, as in buying a company, I used to be a corporate lawyer, so I always talk in corporate terms. But once you take over a government, you have to deal with the civil service, right? They've been in power for 58 years serving one party. That's going to be a problem. So we need to reshuffle them a bit. So that will take time, whether we can translate policy ideas to real action. Okay? And being in a coalition government, we still have to sit down with our partners and try and agree on certain economic policies. So let's sort the democracy dividend out first. And that will allow us 1 year or 2 years to really get hold of the civil service and to make sure they implement whatever we want to pursue. So that's how we're going to do this. We're also going to pare down the national debt. There's no point running a government if you have to pay $25 billion of interest a year just to service the national debt level, which is really high. So the way to do it is to do a management buyout, and this is where I'm talking like a lawyer again, and a management buyout system of the government's SOE, or state-owned enterprises. There are a lot out there. There's a lot of Malaysian government state-owned enterprises. By my calculation, we should be able to raise 150 billion ringgit, and that will bring down the national debt level. Once we get this 150 billion and pay off the bonds, it will bring the national debt level to around 45% of GDP, something totally manageable. And that is what we're going to do in terms of fiscal policy, massaging that. The big issue, of course, is how do we stop this intolerant behavior in the nation? The Chinese needs to face up to the fact that, you know, we are essentially quite racist by nature. You know, like you go to Hong Kong, everybody, all the foreigners get to call Kuai Lo, you call them Kuai Lo, and you know, Kuai Mui, and all sort of words, right? By nature, the Chinese are reactive, and they feel deep dissatisfaction with the way the Malaysian government run their business. But we cannot deny the fact that a lot of the Malays or Bumiputras in Malaysia still need a lot of help. Social and economic-wise, they are really downtrodden. In fact, the Indian community, in fact, has been overlooked a lot. So let's get down to solving the socio-economic issues. The first thing you really have to do in terms of getting the socio-economic issues resolved is to create a middle class. Then the middle class must come from the Malay community and the Indian community in particular. The Chinese community do reasonably well. So we have to roll out programs to lift them up. And this essentially means opening up the unions, bottom line. I'm a corporate lawyer, but I see the value in unions because I believe not in hyper-capitalism, even though I made my money as a capitalist. I believe in a social market economy attuned to Denmark, you know, or Norway, or even Germany, where there's a high level of union activities and also the demands for fair wage. Malaysian companies, I know as a fact, makes a lot of money. It's just that we need to sit down and talk to them and engage them to pay fair wages. If they pay fair wages, we can resolve the racial problems, because nobody, all my friends who are middle class, upper middle class people, we don't fight over race issue. The racism is caught in this bottom 40, 50% of the population, which are struggling day to day. So if we can do that, the country should come up fast to resolve the racial problems. The other big problem we have to resolve is really about education. Malaysian education is quite weird in the sense that we have religious schools, we have national schools, we have Chinese schools, we've got Indian schools, and now we have international schools. Now, the international school is a new phenomenon, international private schools, because Malaysian national school have failed. It's driven by market. There are thousands, you know, there are hundreds of private and internationals coming up in Malaysia. And once you have private and international school, it doesn't help social mobility at all. You're going to create an elitist society. Yeah? So we have to resolve this. I think I will have to end quite soon. I'll just try to wrap up the issue about education. It's important because what we're seeing today is Chinese boys going to Chinese schools and Malays going to Malay school or national school and Indians going to Tamil school. And my kids, the generation of young Malaysians are not even growing up in the same school. What more after they graduate, when they finish, you know, they can't work in Malaysia. They can't, because Malaysia doesn't really exist in. So the way forward is to tackle the education problem, because if we are investing, you know, I mean, doing the management buyout, you know, putting up the Union Bank will solve the issue for short term. Getting this democracy dividend back, all these are short term measures. Long term measures to make sure that the national schools play an important role in fostering national unity. And I think that is the ultimate challenge, because by doing that, by putting the different races in one school, at least they understand and they empathize. And that is what Malaysia really, really have to do. And on that note, thank you very much. I think I'll take the questions now. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Wong Chen. We gave you more time, but okay. I thought you probably cover questions that would be coming up. So now the floor is open. We still have 10 minutes. So please don't forget to introduce yourself. Thank you, this lady. Can you mention also the affiliation, if any?
I'm Jackie Donaldson. I have a PR company and I look after Airbus. I'm a bit disappointed that you didn't spend a little bit more time on the missing plane. I was interested because the headline of the lunch was missing plane, missing billions. And so I'm surprised that it just skirted over it saying Malaysia's a mess and expect to be treated like that. I thought, you know, can you just give us a bit more?
Oh, sure, sure. I think the missing plane story, I mean, nobody knows where the plane is, right, until today, right? In Parliament, we asked for a debate on the issue. That was shot down. It wasn't allowed to do so. And then, of course, we hear the rumours about, you know, the Freescale story, the conspiracy theory about, you know, Diego Garcia and all that. That's just all out there. Do members of parliament believe in this? I think we're just normal human beings. They love to gossip in the halls of power even. What we know is, I think most of us truly believe the Americans know something. And whether that knowledge and that relationship with Najib, Prime Minister Najib and Obama. Now, that is a real relationship between them. So I won't speculate too much whether it's related to MH370, because they're known to be golf buddies, Obama and Najib. They are golf buddies. And we know that the Americans' main interest in Malaysia is to do with the Straits of Malacca. And in particular, it's related to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, this big multilateral free trade agreement that's being negotiated. So I won't say that the MH370 has something directly or indirectly to do with this, but I know that the Americans have a lot of interest in Malaysia going forward. They have a geopolitical strategy to contain China, and the TPP is one of them. Of course, China is trying to do the RCEP to try to open up their position with Malaysia. We know the Chinese companies have taken an interest in one of the major ports in Malaysia, in Kuantan Port. The Americans are worried. Malaysia, diplomatically, has always applied a strategy of being friends with everybody. And I think during the administration, Najib's administration, from the PR side, he has definitely moved closer to the Americans. During Dr. Mahathir's time, is the polar opposite. Okay, I hope I don't want to sound, I sold you a wrong story on this talk. But the MH370 is really a description of what is wrong with the nation. Yeah, I hope you understand. Thank you. Please.
The lady here.
My name is Miss Liang. I'm Malaysian in exile.
Okay.
And I am not as optimistic as you regarding the next election. I'm very happy to hear about the split in the party past. But what had happened is because the madrasas, the religious schools in Malaysia, are funded by the Saudi government. And that was what led to the Islamicization of the schools for the Muslims in our country. So I'm very happy to hear that there are progressives in party past that want to split away from hudud, chopping of hands and silly things like that.
Sure.
But what I'd like to make is a suggestion how you might possibly win the next election.
Okay.
I think you should include the Indians, because the Indians are very unhappy at the moment with the ruling government. And you should also do what Ms. Gordon has bravely been doing, she was giving out radios to the Sikh Dayaks in Sarawak. And she was asked to leave. She was not welcome anymore. So she's now directing it from London, where she's safe. So what I'm saying is, I left my country many years ago, even though I love Malaysia, because there was total discrimination against the Chinese. But at the same time, the Chinese must also do their part. There are a lot of Chinese going abroad to study, and they study medicine, very worthwhile occupation. But when they go back to Malaysia, they don't want to be sent to the kampung to work. Now, it is the kampung that holds the power in the country. The kampung people voted for Najib because they are doing very well. All the land in the kampung, the price has gone up. So your answer lies in not this urbanization program of the DAP. The DAP was trying to, in their campaign, they say they want to give student loans, you know, make the students happy. But the students are already a privileged lot. The fact that they go to university, they're already privileged members of society. You should go out to the kampung, and you should go and get the Chinese to go and work there as doctors and do good works. I'm not going back home. I love my country, but I'm bound to get arrested because I'm very vocal with my views. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
Kampung is a village. It's a village. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Okay. Let me address the issue about winning elections. Like any country in the world, you have always 30% that supports the government and about 30% that supports the opposition. Now, this is almost a scientific bell curve fact. We know that the bulk of the people, which is about 40%, will vote on economic issues. In Malaysia, of course, race becomes an important issue. To address your Indian issue, about 55% of Indians actually support us, the opposition. We like to think that 45% of them will swing to us eventually. But because they come from a very low low poverty, they're in poverty, roughly, because then the election becomes a question about who has the money to give. Now, regarding about the kampung politics, we expect the Islamist progressive people to go down there and fight that battle for us. But even in the kampung, the government just rolled out GST, and that's really hurting everybody. I think there's going to be an 8% swing in the election on these economic issues. Now, a lot, I didn't mention this, but you know, the opposition won 52% of the popular vote in the last election. An 8% swing will essentially means that we will get 60%, right? We won 52%, but we got 40% of parliamentary seat. And this is really incredible. That just shows you the level of gerrymandering or uneven electoral system that Malaysia has. Whereas the government, Najib's government, won 45%, because 3% went to independents, right? They have 45% of the popular vote, but they got 60% of parliamentary seats. This is really incredible. I mean, you know, you need to be a rocket scientist to work out a formula how this can possibly happen, other than outright cheating. Can I, do you have a quick point? Because I think there are other questions. Yeah, sure. No, Sabah Sarawak is very strange. Borneo politics. The Sabah Sarawak people, and I can say this without, you know, getting into trouble, is that they don't really trust the peninsula people, right? They see themselves as a separate people. What they ask for is a fair deal between the peninsula activities and the Sabah Sarawak development. Yeah, Sabah politics is mired by warlord politics. Every single little area has their own little warlords, right? So it's very difficult to actually to cobble any sort of agreement with them. And Sarawak is decidedly with the federal government, because until recently, one of the most corrupt, and I can say this without being sued because it's all out there, is that the former chief minister of Sarawak, everybody knows what he's done to the state. Yeah?
So we have 2 minutes left.
Sure.
I suggest that since we have many questions, people can just through their questions, and then
Wong Chan,
you will
please
try and give a general answer, right? So shall we pick? Yes, there is one question at the back of the room.
My name is Jeremy Stone. I'm just an ordinary member of the club. I was born in Malaysia. I come from a rubber planter's family. My question is relating to your you were talking about social inclusion. My question is about the affirmative policy of the Bumiputras. If you come into power, what's your policy on that issue?
Okay, yeah, affirmative policy. Yeah. Okay.
Let's quickly take the two other questions and then we'll close.
Yes, my name is Andrew Wood. I'm a freelancer, mainly work for the BBC as a business reporter. My wife is Chinese-Malaysian, so I've got an interest there. But continuing from the previous questioner asked, the Bumiputra policy, it looks to me like it's a really nasty, racist policy. Positive discrimination, yes, but actually quite nasty. How can you end it without there being some form of revolution? I really don't see why the Malays should give up, the Bumiputra people should give up power.
Thank you. And then your neighbor?
Yeah, hi, Tony Nefty from CLSA. Mine's just a very quick question. In the event that Najib is forced to step down, who's the likely candidate to be the next Prime Minister of Malaysia?
Okay, let me answer the second one first. If Najib steps down, it really depends on how he steps down. If he steps down voluntarily, most likely I think the Home Minister, who is on his best books at the moment, Zahid Hamidi, might just sneak in. It's clear that the Deputy Prime Minister has made his position clear. he's pushing the envelope a bit. So if Dr. Mahathir and his camp succeed, he's most likely to be Prime Minister. Yeah. Now, affirmative action policy. Pakatan Rakyat is committed to changing from race to class. It doesn't mean that we're going to turn communist or socialist. It's just that we know we did articulate this in 2013 in the election. It's very clear in our manifesto that we will end race policies. We will then focus on whoever makes less than $1,000 a month. That will be our social target. And that will encapsulate roughly about 75% of Malays. So they know the numbers as well. It's just repackaging the issue. But for the first time, we will actually help the Indians and also the urban poor Chinese. There are urban poor Chinese in Malaysia. Yeah. So I think that's how we're gonna address the issue. And my faith in the nation is this. A lot of people don't understand the Malay community is feudalistic in many ways. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that they are open to ideas as well. They, you know, throughout their history, they have ruled Malacca, they have ruled, they have run empires before. They take in ideas and they change. In the 1980s, after the fall of Shah of Iran, they took in Islamic views. And that is why today the country is a bit Islamic than usual, right? But if you have a strong leadership that is committed to progressive ideas, we believe the Malay community will respond also because they respect leadership and they will adjust accordingly. And that is the beauty about Malaysia. The faith in this nation is the fact that the Malay community are sweet, living, kind living people. It is. I'm not trying to sell a story. I mean, you imagine, migrants coming over to Malaysia, right? Like Chinese and Indians, given citizenship, to rebuild the nation as a whole. It just shows how kind they are deep down inside. And I grew up in Kelantan. It's a small little, it's a state up north, 95% Malay. I live with them. And to me, I just feel this deep bond with the Malay community. And I really believe deep down inside, they are just sweet people and they will adjust accordingly. And they will give, they have a good innate sense of what is kindness and what is fair. And that is there lies the real hope of Malaysia. They just need to get back to what they really stand for. Then they need to drop this Islamist trying to be like Saudi Arabians and stuff like that. They just need to drop that. And Rafizi Ramli, which I think is probably the greatest thing to come out of Malaysia for the last 10 years, he represents a really progressive Malay leadership that is open, that is smart. And he told me, in the context of how to write a narrative, that the Malay community really will step up to the plate and do the right thing and go back to where we started as a nation in 1957, that this is a home for all. And hopefully our lady here will come back. You're from Kelantan as well, thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to finish on such a positive note despite the pretty horrendous situation that you've described. Thank you very much, Wang Chen, for what I perceived as a very genuine and thorough assessment of the situation. And thank you all for joining us and for your good questions. Now we're going to give you a little souvenir that people don't use very much in Malaysia, even on election time, but you've won a tie from the FCC as a token of thank you. There you are.